unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
So, official good morning. I wanted to talk about Mel Sojin. We've been talking about nothing special, an ordinary mind, and he was, as I said just before we started, he was the most ordinary, extraordinary person I've ever known. He didn't seem, he didn't act like your idea, my idea of a Zen master. You know, he was just there. Though I have to admit, you know, he scared me. You know, but it took me a while to actually go and talk to him in Doksan. Of course, at first I didn't know what Doksan was. And I think I told you that there was a sign up at the Berkeley Zen Center on the bulletin board, and it said something about Doksan and the form of it or how to sign up for it or something like that. And the text referred to him as Mel, and then in the next sentence referred to him as Sojin. And I thought that was two different people. I mean, who knew? And so that was very confusing to me. And I think I finally asked somebody, and they said, no, no, that's his Dharma name. It's the same guy. And Maylee Scott, who was really my practice leader there, my mentor, and became my very good friend. At any rate, Maylee encouraged me to talk to him and say, you know, he's the abbot, you really should have a relationship with him. So I did. And I remember being scared. I don't think I ever experienced him as the kindly, friendly grandfather figure that many people at Tassajara and within San Francisco Zen Center saw him as. I'm maybe not so much at Berkeley because we saw him more. Because one of the wonderful ordinary things about him was that he didn't just disappear into his office. You know, at Berkeley, as here, there are there's a lecture and then the question and answer and discussion follow immediately in the same place. And then after that, there's tea. And in the before times, there was, you know, tea in the courtyard, and there were cookies and herbal tea and a caffeine tea. And he would simply be there. And it did, whether he gave the lecture or not, he would just be there at tea and people would be chatting with him. But, and it never felt like an appearance from on high or something. And the same after a jukai, a giving of the precepts or reception or whatever, he was there. And people say, when Berkeley Zen Center was first starting, and it was a relatively small event in an attic on Dwight Way, that he was always around, and he would be working in the garden. You could go any time of the day, and he'd be working in the garden. By the time I came on the scene, he was there a lot too, but he was in his office. And I know, I mean, for me, I could go knock on the door anytime, but I was pretty senior by the time that I was doing such things. I don't know if that was easy for anybody to do. Maybe it was. that's just, there's just a sense of that Mel is there. And he was there in the sense of being present when you talked with him. I really do miss him, and I forget. I forget, and I'm talking about him, and I'm near tears. But want him back. That was my experience of him in Doksan. He wouldn't necessarily remember what you said before. And I think I was told to, you know, when I wanted to refer it back to something that he'd said, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago or whatever, I would tell him, you know, tell him like what I said and then how he responded. And he'd often say, oh, that was good. And at the same time, my feeling was, though he didn't remember, that he was just completely present right now, and he would respond from there. And he didn't need to remember what happened 3 weeks ago or a year and a half ago. And when we were having a hard time with each other, and irritating each other a lot, one of the things that struck me was that every time I went to see him, even though the last time we had sort of ended at loggerheads in some way or some difficulty, every time I'd walk in the door of the Doksan hut, he would meet me and he would be happy to see me. He would seem completely open. And that was really something. I first met him at Green Gulch because I had been going to the Berkeley Zen Center for a few weeks. And I always wore the same thing. I had a green cotton sweater, just a green cotton crew neck sweater. And I don't remember, I probably wore some kind of loose fitting slacks or something. Or maybe, I don't know. Anyway, I remember wearing that sweater and sort of became my robe. And then he gave a talk at Green Gulch. And I guess I had been coming on Saturdays for a little while, but I came at 9:30 when there was already a big crowd there, and then there was a tea with all kinds of people, and I never approached him. And I might not have gone to lecture much because I tended to work on Saturdays. So at any rate, after the lecture there, it was in the before times at Green Gulch, on the deck above the dining room, there was tea and muffins. And so I was there, and I was eating a muffin and drinking my tea, and I saw him, and he was kind of alone for a moment. So I thought I should go introduce myself. So I go over and I introduce myself, and I was like eating the muffin at the same time. I was really, really nervous. Was really nervous, and so with my mouth, maybe not first. I like to think that it wasn't at first, but anyway, I introduced myself, and he said, "Yeah, I recognize the sweater because he did that walk around. It's called a jundo every morning, so he'd see my back, he'd see the sweater, and then I would leave after 40 minutes, as is okay at Berkeley, and because I had to go walk." The dog at the time, and get to work. So I couldn't stay for the last 20 minutes in service. So I'd never seen him face to face. Anyway, and he said, I recognize the sweater. And I think I this is a nervous conversation. Maybe on both our parts. Anyway, I think I just repeated what I'd said, but by then I did have a bite of muffin. And I said something about, yeah, I just thought it'd be good to meet you because I come a lot or something like that. And he said, yeah, and I recognize the swooper. And then I was like, so I don't know if that got caught on my mic. Steve said Mel Brooks, and it does sound like Mel Brooks or Bob and Ray, which is a really old reference. But it was, you know, it was kind of sweet. And that may have been when I decided maybe I needed to go actually do Doksan with him. And I was afraid, of him for a long time, which is part of why it was difficult. Well, we had our difficult time because I was afraid of him, and I didn't feel like he was safe. And if you're not safe, then my commitment issues get triggered. That before I commit, I want you to be absolutely 120% safe, which of course is ridiculous and impossible. Because none of us is entirely safe. In other words, we act out, we lash out, we say unskillful things, blah, blah, blah. So at some point I started going to Saturday morning lecture, and I don't know when exactly. So let me just ask if you have, could you put the clock where I can see it? If you have any questions or anything you've always wondered about, or.
When did you lose your fear of Mel, if ever?
I think it was, I've told this story before, but I told most of it before, so I'm going to stop saying that. We had, as I say, once I started seeing him regularly, and I think I got triggered. And it was like he couldn't say anything right. And I would see him, I was meaning to see him as my teacher every other week. Mm-hmm. That was back when you could do that. Nowadays it's too big and too complicated. But I would see him every other week. The thing is, I'd see him, and then something would happen, and we'd get into some kind of messy thing, or he'd say something that hurt my feelings or something. So then I would sign up to see him the following week in order to work it through. And then I'd see him the next week because I saw him every other week. So I was seeing him a lot, and we were having a lot of difficult conversations. And part of it was that I would bring up something and he didn't remember it really. And I would be trying to convince him how he was wrong. And one of the things, the side issue thing, but one of the things he taught me without meaning to teach me was how to confront him and how to confront anybody. You know, if my feelings were hurt, to learn to say as soon as possible, "Ouch, when you said X, I felt Y." You shouldn't have said X, or X was a hurtful thing to say, or why are you so mean? So nothing, just really clean. That hurt. When you said that, I was hurt. And as soon as possible. And then he could respond. And he often apologized, not always. But it was difficult, and it wasn't all my fault. I mean, he was unkind sometimes, or he was unskillful sometimes. And luckily, I had Maylee to go to and say, "This is what happened." And she'd say, "Oh." What I remember is her saying, "Oh, that wasn't necessary." And I remember kind of thinking, So it was necessary to say it in some other way? You know, I don't know. But at any rate, it was a lifesaver for me to have a woman mentor. At any rate, this went on for a while. And finally, he said, you've been coming to see me a lot. And sometimes a teacher sends a student away to work something through and then come back. I'm not ready to do that. This yet was hanging in the balance. And that got my attention. So I started talking to my analyst about it and owning my stuff, and taking back some of my projections. And that's when I began to realize how much of a father authority, male authority person he was for me, and how much my commitment issues were triggered. And so I turned inwardly. I did my homework and owned how desperately I wanted a good daddy. And I wanted a good father. And I wanted that person to be, as I said, 120% safe. And I sat with how much it hurt, that longing, that wanting a good daddy, how much it hurt. And and how angry I was, am, about male authority. But I took the projection back, you know, and there is a problem with white male authority in our society, but it isn't all male's fault, you know, and he only has so much control of it, and he was about 20 years older than I was. So it was from a, you know, certain background and culture and whatever, and there was only so much that he was going to do. And that wasn't what I wanted from him. You know, I wanted him to be my Zen teacher. I didn't really want him to be my good daddy. I mean, in one sense, I wanted him to put me in his pocket and just carry me around safe. But that wasn't what I really wanted. That was what I subconsciously wanted. We all did. I don't think this is actually anything weird. I think I had a bad case of it. But at any rate, in that process, I did work through a lot of stuff about my father and about fathers, or the iconography of, or archetype of a father and male authority and so on. And became much less reactive to him, and also less afraid, and more willing to just say, you know, if he did say something skillful, to say, ouch. And I think he became more aware, you know, that I don't know, I guess I'd say that he could trigger me. I think he could trigger anybody, but what comes to me now is an exchange at Tassajara. He led the first Baptist period I did there, and he would be there for a while, and then he would leave. And Blanche was around a lot. I think Ed Brown was there some of the time, because he had a young son, Daniel, who was, I don't know how old Daniel was at the time, like 10 or 11. And so Mel didn't feel like he could leave for 3 months straight. Plus, of course, there was the Berkeley Zen Center. So he would be there, say, for the first 2 or 3 weeks, and then he'd be gone for a couple of weeks, and then he'd be back, and then he might even go again for a little bit. And I, at one point, when he had just recently come back, and he had a Xerox of a Roz Chast cartoon from the New Yorker, and in the courtyard, one afternoon, he called me over and he showed it to me, and he said, I thought you might like this. And it was a baggage carousel at an airport, but it was titled Emotional Baggage, and all the little bags had, I don't know what, anxiety and whatever. And I immediately felt hurt. I mean, I saw it was funny. I might have even seen it before, I don't know, but I thought it was funny, but I was also hurt because I thought he was talking about me, because I felt like I do have a lot of emotional baggage, as do we all. At any rate, I laughed and I turned to walk away, and it's like a bell or light went on for him, I think. He said, Mary, did you think I was referring to you? You know, and I said, yes, and I wasn't hurt, and I was proud of that. I really was not so triggered by it. I was hurt by it, actually, but I wasn't going to lash out at him about it. And he said, no, I wasn't thinking of you. So that was nice. But what I'm saying is, he apparently had learned something, because he realized that could trigger me. So in that process, I mean, we got to know each other, and then I wasn't so afraid of him. So that's a long answer. Yes.
First of all, thanks for sharing all this. It's. Is there something that you learned from him? Well, I'm sure there's a lot of things, but could you share something you learned from him that you think has made you a good teacher / priest / abbess / or maybe more than one thing?
Good, I don't know, you don't see. But there are a lot of things, but what comes to mind is that he, to quote, I think it was Dongshan, at any rate, that he didn't tell me the answers. And he gave me my first real challenging koan, which was case 55 of the Blue Cliff Record, alive or dead koan, when my parents were dying. And I had to, he said, just the Dongshan, so almost offhand, he said, well, you might take a look at case 55 of the Blue Cliff Record. And one of the things that I did, I mean, as a Zen student, I tried to do, at least try on what he said to do, not that I had to, but to at least try it on. And so I went and found case 55 and read it, and it was, they go to pay a condolence call in the student slaps the coffin and says, tell me, teacher, alive or dead? And the teacher says, I won't say. And the student says, you have to tell me, I need to know. You know, it wasn't an academic question for him. It was really a big deal. And the teacher repeats that. And then they're walking back towards the monastery after, and the student says, if you don't tell me, I'll hit you. I have to know, alive or dead. And the teacher says, well, hit me if you need to, but I won't say. And so the student hits him, and then the teacher sends the student away because he got a bloody nose, and if they went back to the monastery, the student would be in deep doo-doo. And years later, after the teacher has died, and the student winds up back there at that same monastery, and he's talking to the head monk and asks him what it means, and the head monk says, I won't say. At that point, the student wakes up. So he never talked to me about it. So we talked about death a lot, but we never talked about it. And I just kept reading it and thinking, my first response was that teacher was really mean, because he didn't say, I can't say. He said, I won't say. It just seemed so rude and so mean. I kept thinking, there's gotta be, he wouldn't give this to me just because of that. There's gotta be more here. And so I just kept reading it over and over and over again and chewing on it. And then it eventually started opening up for me, and I learned. I still chew on it. So that, I learned a lot from that koan and from the process. I mean, that's who I am. I pay attention to the process every time I was in Doksan or practice discussion with lots and lots of people. I'm always, part of me is kind of watching how they respond, learning what to do and what not to do. So that's one.
Yeah, I just wondered at Berkeley Zen Center, because you were going for Dokusan with Mel, the abbot, is it just assumed that he's your teacher and you're his student? Or do you have to formally ask? I always wondered about that. Is it a formal request? You know, I mean, I know there's no ceremony or anything, but
he always assumed that everybody that came in the door was his student. And he was mostly right, but not always. And I mean, when I started there, I was working with a person that I went to a retreat to start. That's how my practice started, really. And it was led by a woman named Yvonne Rand, and I was seeing Yvonne, and I considered her my teacher. And then slowly it started. She lived in New York Beach, and for various reasons it sort of petered out or whatever, and that relationship ended, and I started seeing Mel very regularly. And at Berkeley, so I say, there's no ceremony at Berkeley, there is here. And I've done that with a few people. And I have to tell you, just like being a chip off the old block, I don't remember for sure with whom I've done it. And I do know some, and we say, you know, don't disappear. And if you have a difficulty with me, talk about it. And then they disappear, and they don't talk about it. And I mean, they disappear for all kinds of reasons, and not because of a difficulty with me particularly, but you know, it's like saying that the lines in the middle of a sutra are dotted lines. It just seems, I don't know. But that means you follow the doshi that, you know, that doesn't seem to register. I bet it registers now with a lot of Dohans with whom I've had a similar conversation these last few days. But at any rate, it's just assumed. And then there was somebody that did Jukai with Paul Haller at San Francisco Zen Center, and Bell was irritated. He thought the guy was his student. But, you know, we all suffer from a disease. It's called, if I wasn't there, it didn't happen. And because I saw this kid at Green Gulch and at City Center a lot. Maybe at City Center, whatever. But he was there a lot. But Mel didn't see that. And he saw him at Berkeley Zen Center, so he just assumed. Anyway, and of course, with Alan coming forward in the last few years, that's changed. And it's also, it's starting to change. It is changing that some of the more senior people now kind of have students, you know, and there was recently a Jukai at Berkeley, where there were four people that took the precepts, and two were Alan students, and two were Jerry Oliva students. So it's starting to open up a little bit, because he was the founder, and it was so much his place. And it's hard to let go. I mean, it changes. You know, as soon as you start talking about retiring, like Barbara Kahn said, what happened at Austin Zen Center was that her successor was there, and as soon as she was known to be retiring, some question would come up, and instead of the eyes turning to her, as had always been the case, they turned to him. You know, and when Mel talked about retiring when he was 80, that he was going to retire when he was 80. It took him another, what, 13 years or something. But when he talked about it, he said that, well, he and I talked about it because that you could feel the attention, you know, and he was saying, you know, I think probably around 80, and say he was 75 or something. You can feel the power going away, and people would come up to him and say, well, how's retirement? He said, wait a minute, I haven't even set a date, you know. So it's been very much focused on him until the last, I don't know, it's been changing the last 5 or 10 years, something that some people, you know, would refer to our teachers, plural. People saw Alan more as a baby and became the vice abbot. Mm-hmm. And, anyway.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You got it. You online are welcome to ask questions or say whatever you want also. But you're muted, so it doesn't work very well.
Well, I didn't have a particular question, but I really appreciate hearing more about Sojin and their relationship, and points at where it gets kind of deeper into practice, and I don't know what it, how his teaching was.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn, you're welcome also, by the way. She's not required. Did you looked like you were about to ask something or say something.
Yeah. After all this, I feel that this is such a trivial question, but do you know who had the bumper sticker? Okay, so first, as some background, in case everyone doesn't know this, there were bumper stickers for quite a while that were people would have bumper stickers on their car that would say, what would Jesus do? And somebody at Berkeley Zen Center had one that said, what would Mel do? And I just found that so annoying that somebody would put his name in place of Jesus. I wonder if you ever saw that and know who that was.
Yes, and I can't remember, or at least I've heard about it. And I don't know, you know, he was very impatient, and there are things that I wouldn't suggest that you... he was impatient about little things. You know, when he was my passenger, he'd keep telling me to change lanes to get there faster, you know. Or he didn't like that I changed into the exit lane 3/4 of a mile ahead of the exit, because that would be the right lane, right? That'd be the slow lane. And he complained about that. And when I was his passenger, he just changed lanes. I don't know if he even looked over his shoulder or looked in the rear mirror. He just changed lanes. And then somebody'd honk at him and he'd go, ah! Wow. like they were wrong.
I seem to recall when they were doing remembrances online that Alan said that he took a photo of him from the back, I think, and he made the bumper stickers, and he was going to make some more. But he said they don't last a real long time.
Yeah, well, anyway, it's not useful to him or to anybody to make him into a saint. I mean, I know you're perfect, which is a reference to, I know I said it the other day. I know I said I was gonna stop saying it. Last year sometime I gave a lecture at Berkeley Zen Center, and he was there, and in the process I said something I often say, which is, I know a number of people I think of as Zen masters, but not one of them is perfect. And then he leans forward from his seat off to my right on the other side of the altar, he leans forward and he says, except me. So that became a running joke for the rest of the lecture. And it, so except for Mel, anyway, he wasn't perfect, and I don't think he wanted to be seen as perfect. He expected you to listen to him, but he didn't expect you to put him up on a pedestal. And if he did do something unskillful or something you disagreed with, you wanted to hear about it. He was not patient with people who were working through their own authority issues or people that are just critical. I'd like to think I wasn't quite that bad, but and he could be short with people like that. And as Maley said to one of them at one point, and I think it was true, that Mel was a good mirror. So when you're getting that kind of response, that's your stuff. It's something for you to look at. And I think there was a lot of truth to that. But making him into a saint, you know, it often happens, you know, that Dogen didn't call himself a Zen. He said, I'm just a Buddhist. But here we are, revering Dogen. So I think it's important to not revere Mel, though I guess I do revere Mel, but I'd like to think that I also see him and saw him and saw his unskillfulness or his problems. And when it becomes sort of worshiping it, then the other side also comes up with that. So if you make him perfect and then he says something imperfect, then sometimes you have to reject him completely because he wasn't perfect. You know, that would just, when we're not aware of how much we want that safety, it's a problem. Yeah. Okay, this is the last one.
I really like the photo. That's what Suzuki Roshi.
Yeah, that's the founder's area there.
And there's something's crooked, but you can't tell which one it is, which is perfect.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
But I think it's Suzuki Roshi. Yes.
I think so, but when
you
I
got
was...
more crooked, did you notice that?
Yes. But when I was standing over there the other day and I looked over, and I think Mel's is a little...
It depends what angle you're looking from, I think.
And my inclination, like in my house, I'm always straightening. There's one picture in our bathroom that is always crooked. And it's like a practice moment to just leave it.
Yeah. But yeah, I told the story that in Crooked Cucumber, it talks about somebody going through a room with Suzuki Roshi, just ahead of Suzuki Roshi, and the picture was crooked, and the person straightened the picture, and Suzuki Roshi was right behind him and unstraightened it. And my experience is that when the pictures of Suzuki Roshi in the founders area at City Center and at Tassajara, they're often a little bit crooked. And I don't, you know, somebody straightens them and then they get crooked again. And I mentioned it to Reb, and I showed him now three times, and he told me the first time I showed it to him that the person who straightened the picture was Dick Baker. So that's interesting. So yes,
I just wanted to know if everyone knows that that's Mel's robe that you were.
I don't know. Probably not. This is Mel's robe. I inherited it. I was talking with Alan about finding a robe for him to. Mel left him his robe and his bowl in Mel's will, but he had a lot of okesas. This is called an okesa. And so we were going to give it to him and did give it to him formally here, his disciples, Mel's disciples, but we had to choose which one it was going to be. So we were in Mel's office, which I don't, you know, Alan's calling it the Abbott's office, but I think he doesn't yet feel like it's his office, but it is his office. At any rate, we were in that office, and I said that I could use a robe. And so he said, well, why don't you take this one? Because he was looking at the very fancy ones for himself, that it probably ought to be a ceremonial robe, the kind that's lined, like I wear for the full moon ceremony and some others. So this one was a you know, an everyday robe, and it's old, but it's holding up very well. It's a lot better shape than mine, so I appreciate it. And I guess it's not exactly a dialogue. He hasn't responded, but I talked to him about it, because it's he would be get too warm very easily. And this is a very, very lightweight, I guess it's cotton. It might be cotton and something, but it's very lightweight, so that when you go to fold it, it doesn't fall into place. It doesn't have the weight to fall into place, and so it's hard to get it folded right. So, and then I feel like I'm either doing it in here, where there's a founder's area picture. There's a picture of him in the Doksan room, staring at you. And so I feel like I'm taking it off and he's watching me. So I complain. He's used to it. Anyway, we should stop. I think we can continue this. But please feel invited to ask me. I don't know what all to talk about. But and I thought it would be useful to have a talk recorded where I talked about him at some length, and I have a little bit of distance, not much, from his death. And at some point, January 7th is the anniversary, and we need to think about how we would observe that.